Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
Well, as always, it's great to have you back again as we explore the exciting world of the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. In the first half hour, you're going to get to meet a guy by the name of Lawrence Frittle. He serves as the director of NASA's Earth Science Division's Applied Sciences Program. He's a speaker at the IEEE Global Humanitarian Technology Conference going on October 30th through November 1st in Seattle. And you may not know this, but NASA, the toilets all flush at the same time. I mean, the people flush the toilet. They didn't have it automatically. The people actually flush the toilets all at the same time, and he's going to... We get to find out why, among other things, from Lawrence. And then later on in the program, Major General Joseph C. Carter, the Adjutant General of the Massachusetts National Guard, is going to stop in, tell us about the challenges that go on with Homeland Security and how the National Guard has to be prepared. He's a speaker at the Homeland Security Technologies Conference, sponsored by Raytheon, coming up in a couple of weeks. And we're going to visit the Den of Strangers, visit our fountain of useless information we have, and of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. So let's get right to our first guest. All right, at this time I want to introduce you to Lawrence Frittle. He's the director of the NASA Earth Science Division's Applied Science Program. And Lawrence, we're really, really happy to have you with us. Thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you.
You're going to be a speaker at the IEEE Global Humanitarian Technologies Conference. It's going on October 30th through November 1st, I believe, in Seattle. And can you tell us some of the things you're going to cover during that conference?
Certainly. At this conference, we wanted to be talking about the role and the opportunities that Earth-observing satellites can play in helping with humanitarian efforts and international development activities. The nation, especially the United States and a number of other nations, have been developing a number of different Earth-observing satellites that look back at the Earth and observe environmental, weather, climate, and climate conditions, and really look at the environment in many different ways, from the oceans, the atmosphere, the land, the ice, and the cryosphere. And we're doing it primarily for scientific purposes to understand changes that are occurring in the Earth, although we recognize the fact that the observations that we're collecting also have immediate value in supporting management and policy making activities, especially natural resource management activities. And so one of the things we wanted to be informing this audience about are the opportunities that these types of observations can provide for humanitarian and international development efforts. For example, there could be some things related to public health and the environmental conditions that lead to indicators for conditions that are going to lead to infectious disease and outbreaks of those infectious diseases. There's also a number of activities related to water quality and water quantity, food security types of issues. Environmental factors play into a lot of the humanitarian issues that that the countries in the world are trying to address in order to improve the quality of life for everyone on the planet.
Well, did you say that NASA is working on detecting what disease outbreaks? Is that what I heard? Thought I heard you say.
The detection is. From the satellites can identify some of the environmental conditions that are associated with some of these infectious disease outbreaks.
Okay.
For example, with malaria, there are some environmental factors that contribute to the breeding of mosquitoes that that carry malaria.
Okay.
For example, surface temperature, precipitation levels, relative humidity, and the satellites can be identifying these factors, these environmental factors, across broad ranges and broad scales. And when you have the appropriate combination of these environmental factors that create the conditions in which the mosquitoes are going to be breeding, that can give you some sort of lead time for when you might be able to determine where and when an outbreak would occur. And so therefore, we're not able to, we're able to determine the environmental conditions. We cannot identify from the satellites the malaria or the mosquitoes, but what we can do is look at the environmental conditions that are associated with those vectors.
Okay, so you can look at an area and you can say, well, it's going to get real rainy and swampy there and in a little bit, and we can see that this weather patterns are going to be over this area for a long time, and that's going to lead for a malaria outbreak because they're equatorial or they're in some particular area where that's going to happen. And you can alert the humanitarian rescue people to be alert that there could be an outbreak of malaria. Is malaria the only disease we're talking about, or are there other factors?
We've been looking at and studying to see whether we can be doing this for other factors as well. Rift Valley fever and other hemorrhagic fevers is another one. There's also been some work related to Ebola. And so those are some of them. And we're looking to determine, can we be doing this for other types of infectious disease? Those are waterborne, and so we're going to be looking to see whether we can do it for some of the other vector-borne diseases.
What about ocean levels? The Maldives are very concerned. There, in fact, is the average elevation above sea level in the Maldives there in the Indian Ocean is about 4 feet, and I understand the highest spot on the Maldives is 7 feet, and they're talking about the oceans are rising up there, and they're afraid the Maldives are going to disappear entirely. And my question is, are they sinking, or is the sea level rising, or do you know?
Well, certainly the observations that NASA has been collecting, and a lot of it has been cooperation with other countries as well, is trying to get a long-term record so that we can be determining what the rate of sea level rise is. And certainly we've been seeing, you know, with the climate changes that we've been seeing, that we have been getting, you know, gradual but ever-increasing sea level rise changes. And so the science is sort of indicating that, you know, that with sea level rise, it is going to put some of these island nations potentially at risk. And so that leads to sort of policy and management decisions that both the Maldives, as well as the international community will need to address. And so we can be providing the observations, we can be providing the trends, and the processes that are going to be going on in the environment, but it's really going to be up to the policy and management community to determine what to be doing with that information. The other thing I'd point out is, even if they, based on the sea level rise, even before sea level rise would affect whether the islands are above or below water, storm surge is going to be quite affected as sea level rises. So we're going to see the effects of storm surge long before we ever see those islands underwater.
Storm surge, you mean storm surge at the Maldives or Maldives, or do you mean storm surge all over the planet?
Well, it's certainly going to be a number of places, and that's going to affect, you know, all over the planet. I specifically was referring to the Maldives because the initial question was related to that. But you're correct that we are going to start seeing effects, the storm surge effects in different parts of the world as sea level rises. And to some degrees, in some of the areas where you have a lot of marshlands and a lot of estuaries, I think we'll start to see saltwater incursion into some of these estuaries. And I think it'll be a factor to determine, I think one of the things that will determine is how quickly those ecosystems can adapt to a potentially higher salinity environment, and so those ecosystems that can adapt and can evolve to adopt, you know, to accommodate the higher salinity. When you do have more saltwater intrusion, we'll be doing better than some of the ecosystems that are going to be highly affected by saltwater.
Where are some of the points of concern right at the moment? A place like Bangladesh or New Orleans, or what are we talking about? I mean, where are you seeing this being the biggest immediate threat?
There's certainly going to be some estuaries along the Gulf Coast, where we've been looking. So we have not been looking globally. I mean, we're certainly identifying that, and different countries can be looking at that.
Okay.
Within our program, we've been trying to help people within the Gulf of Mexico region to see where there's going to be effects, especially given in the U.S. what's happened post Hurricane Katrina, as well as the oil spill. So we've been looking to try and focus some of the resources to see how those communities along the Gulf Coast are going to recover. And might be able to utilize the Earth observations to support their community development and their resiliency for future hurricanes or for sea level rise.
Okay, what are some of the points that you want to really drive home when you deliver your presentation at the IEEE Global Humanitarian Technology Conference in Seattle?
I would say that I want to be pointing out that NASA currently has 15 satellites that are up there looking at environmental conditions, and these are just 15 of many, many satellites that are looking back at the Earth from the looking at the Earth science and looking at the environmental conditions all around, and that the space program is, obviously been highly successful relative to the space shuttle and space station, but really wanted to be pointing out that the long-term records that exist by having these satellites in orbit really provide this opportunity to look at management policy issues, and that the need is not necessarily for high-resolution imagery. Certainly those play fantastic roles in identifying actions of specific individuals or organizations on the ground. I want to point out there's organizations like the Satellite Sentinel Program that I think through transparency measures, and using the satellites in high resolution can identify specific actions that people are taking. But I want to be pointing out that when it comes to humanitarian efforts, I think the broad trends and the stresses that changes in the environment and the changes in climate are going to be introducing, that I think that is an important aspect of the humanitarian relief efforts, both the long-term planning and the specific response activities for disasters, and that the role of satellites can play in supporting the long-term risk assessments, the disaster response, and all the planning activities and the recovery efforts, that I think we can't overlook the value that these Earth observations are going to be providing. And what I hope to be doing is providing a few examples in a number of different areas of humanitarian efforts, and to just show where the value of the Earth observations can be.
So you're going to have photographs, and you're going to have some graphs and other stuff like that. People are going to have some visuals people are going to see and appreciate?
Absolutely. We're hoping to show a number of examples of both what the observations can see and then how that relates to the specific actions and management activities that are occurring. And so I talked about the malaria example earlier on, and I'm going to be definitely showing how the satellites can be identifying some of the environmental conditions and how the blending of that, how that relates to malaria, conditions that are conducive to malaria outbreaks. And we're going to be looking at a number of different satellite images and then relating that to the humanitarian efforts, and then sort of asking the question, how might we, as the technology-focused community, how might we bring this into the humanitarian relief efforts, both from a policy and a management standpoint?
So you're going to be there gathering information as much as you're giving. You're not going to go in and with a prescribed thing and say, look, these are things we got to really be careful of and watch for, and these are warning signs. What you're going to be doing is asking the question of the other people that are there, saying, you know, this is what we can do. Here's our satellite images. This is what we can show. How can we be of help? Is that what you're saying?
It's going to be a little of both. I think what we want to be doing is providing a few examples so that some of the people there who may work on the ground doing humanitarian efforts will see these examples, and they'll know how they can be applying them, and they'll contact us to understand how we can help them apply it. So one, we want to be sharing examples that people can then implement in areas that we're not aware of. And then secondly, it's also going to be doing a lot of listening to understand what are the primary concerns that they have. And we'll be filtering through to understand, okay, where can satellite observations provide the sort of support that some of the people need. So obviously satellites, you know, have strengths and weaknesses. There are, you know, capabilities that they have and some limitations. And so we're going to be looking to see where are they most appropriately suited for some of the needs that people at the conference are going to be coming and describing.
Well, this is going to be a fascinating time, and we're certainly going to enjoy meeting you October 30th through November 1st in Seattle at the IEEE Global Humanitarian Technology Conference. And, Lawrence, I noticed that you were part of the Space Shuttle Flight Program. You were a controller, I think, at NASA's Mission Control Center for, 15 missions? Is that right?
Yeah, back in the early 1990s, I worked in the Mission Control Center working on the Space Shuttle program. And actually, one of the early missions that I worked on when I was just starting my career was looking at, it was one of the Earth science missions. And the remote sensing and the Earth observations activities that were going on in those shuttle missions eventually led me to be interested in the policy and the management applications of space-based observations of the Earth, and it really led me on a path here. So yes, everything sort of for me started with an interest in the space shuttle program, and really it was that you know launched me into this interest in Earth observations for policy and management.
Well, now you got to tell us how did you get started in that field? How did you become a space shuttle flight controller?
It was actually coming out of college. One of the companies that was working, that was a contractor for NASA for the space shuttle program, interviewed on the college campus. And so I initially interviewed after the Challenger disaster. And so they they weren't hiring at the time, but I kept the person's business card. And then when they returned to flight, I contacted the person again. I had graduated by that point, and they were hiring, and I connected up with them, and it was just it was a fantastic opportunity to serve my country in working for the space shuttle program. And it was a fantastic opportunity. I would say that the one thing that NASA does really well and really did well with the space shuttle program was all of the practicing and the simulations prior to any one of those space shuttle missions. We had drilled and gone through so many different scenarios that oftentimes the shuttle flights were quite uneventful compared to all the practices that we had been through. So there were a lot of simulated anomalies that would go on during the pre-flight simulations, but during the actual missions, there were very few problems, and so it provided a great opportunity to sort of learn what was going on in each of the missions. Eventually, I worked for 15 different shuttle missions, and I was the lead for my office on three of them. And two of those three actually wound up being Earth science missions. And so it really fed this interest of mine in Earth science.
So you really started right after the Challenger disaster. I think that was 1986, if I remember correctly. And give us some stories. I mean, what was it like being there in the control room with all these brilliant people and the exciting opportunities of the space shuttle flights?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, the Challenger accident was January of 1986, and the return to flight was September 1988. I wound up joining NASA in the May 1989 time frame. And I would say that the thing about the as I mentioned earlier, about the Mission Control Center is that because everyone is so focused on making sure that the shuttle was safe and that the mission would be successful and that the focus was on were we providing the scientific return, that the missions were exciting both before and after, but during the time when you're in the Mission Control Center, you are so focused on monitoring systems and playing out contingency scenarios in your head so that you're always prepared that the missions themselves were actually uneventful in mission control, but that's the way you wanted it to be. You didn't want anomalies to be going on in the missions, and so I know your question about what are the exciting times, and certainly, you know, every time when a mission finally landed and we knew the scientific information was going to be coming back home, that's the time when we were all finally relieved, and that's the time we could finally celebrate. Certainly there are times during the missions when a satellite that NASA was carrying or the shuttle was carrying, when it finally launched and it was on its way to Jupiter or to the Sun or to a number of other missions, those were certainly times when it was when you were excited and very proud to be part of NASA and to be part of the space program, and proud on behalf of the international scientific community that they were going to be getting the scientific data that they had waited so long for. But I would say that a lot of the excitement was going to be both before and after the missions, simply because of when your time on console, you are so focused that it's a pretty unemotional time because you need it to be unemotional. You need to be focused on what's going on with the shuttle systems.
So the times you were chewing your fingernails was during launch, and then during a reentry. Once the mission was underway, it was just a matter of being pretty routine monitoring of the different things that are going on. Is that what you're saying?
More or less. But while you're monitoring the systems in the on orbit phase. As a flight controller, you're constantly trying to think about scenarios that could happen, and you're constantly thinking about contingencies that you need to be preparing for. And so there's a lot of things that go on orbit, and that's oftentimes, you know, when we were launching, for example, the Ulysses satellites, you know, or the Galileo satellites that was going off to study the Sun or Jupiter. And so that certainly the times when you're doing those specific launches or doing, you know, specific scientific endeavors, you were certainly biting your nails then. But again, it was trying to go through and make sure that you've double-checked, triple-checked your calculations so that any of the things or figures that you were giving to other people in the Mission Control Center or sending up to the astronauts, you wanted to make sure that they were correct.
So... We envision the control centers as being pretty humorless. I mean, a lot of people very serious and very intent on things. But do you have a particular memory of something that happened that was particularly funny during your time as a space shuttle flight controller that you can relate with us?
I would say that that oftentimes the thing that was fun to watch. Was when the astronauts that were on the ground were the ones that got to pick out the music for the wake-up calls for the astronauts that were on board. And so as a flight controller, you were always in the dark about what the music was going to be.
Oh.
But the astronauts who were on the ground were always trying to pick out some fun songs that that the people up on orbit would listen to as their morning wake-up calls. And so sometimes it was the theme.
Okay, I need you to hold that thought for a minute while we take a break and be right back. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. In the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
Andrew Carnegie, it's true that every nation regards and proclaims its own armaments as instruments of peace only. But just as naturally, every nation regards every other nation's armaments as clearly instruments of war. Thus, each nation suspects all the others. Only a spark is needed to set fire to the mass of inflammable material.